Daniel Grindstaff, you probably know him as a banjo player with Jim and Jesse. He's appeared with Rhonda Vincent. He's played with the Osborne Brothers. Some remarkable stories behind his career, which is nearly legendary at this point. Daniel took some time off from being a performing musician to raise a family. He's now back in a big way with a brand new band with his friend Tim Raybon. The band is called Merle Monroe. The brand new album is Back to the Country. Daniel's my guest in the second hour of today's program. So much information, so much detail. Daniel's an excellent, excellent banjo player. Merle Monroe is Back to the Country. It's a very good album. Daniel Grindstaff, my very special guest, and you're going to enjoy the program. I am really happy to welcome the Unreal Bluegrass for the first time, my friend, Daniel Grindstaff. How are you, Daniel?
Oh, thank you, Steve. Man, I'm doing well. We've talked about it a lot. But
yeah, we have.
Pull the trigger until now, I guess, right?
No, we never have, and we've known each other for a long time. We have a good mutual friend that connects us in discussions every once in a while. That being our Sonny. I mean, that's just the position that he's in with a lot of people. But so I've always felt like I knew you better than I did, even though I met you. I knew of you. I have the album that you did, and I met you years ago when you were playing with Marty Raybon. I went to something not too far from where I live because I wanted to see you playing, and we chatted a little bit then. That was the very first bit of it, but I've always been a fan of your music, and here we are back to talk about a brand new band that you're a part of. It's doing very well, Merle Monroe. You have a new album, Back to the Country, on Pinecastle.
Yes, sir.
I've been playing it on Unreal Bluegrass. I think it's getting a lot more play than maybe even you or Tim Raybon, we'll mention your names first, expected it to get.
The album has pleasantly surprised us. You know, it was released last Friday, but, you know, the way it is with record companies now, they'll send the album out or singles out to guys much like yourself and get a feel for the water and try to get the album some traction before the release date. And we're very pleasantly surprised with how the album's doing. And you know, it comes down to much like when Pinecastle sends you a record, you review it, and if it's something that stands out, you decide to play it. So fortunately, folks have decided to play it. And, you know, and people that listen have decided to requested after they hear it, and so that's had a good effect for us.
It really has, and I'll use this term, although I don't know that it even ever makes sense, but it's kind of a whisper campaign. There hasn't been a big huge announcement of it. It's just kind of been sneaking out. You did the song Dad was available before Father's Day, and that was perfect timing, and so you've just kind of been letting it find its way, and you let the demand. This is me from the outside, from what I see. I know you're working harder than it might appear to me or to the listeners, but I think it's out there now. And now you're, like you said, it was just released recently, although it's been talked about, and people have had cuts to play it. So I think it's kind of has a foundation of its own, and now people can actually get the Back to the Country album and listen to the whole thing. I mean, I don't think that was an accident.
No, to be honest with you, all of that was pretty well planned by me and Tim and the team we've got at Pinecastle. And, you know, it all got into motion the summer of 18. I'd left Marty Raybon in 2012, and I'd met Tim through that. And, of course, all of us are very, very good friends. Me and him and Marty are all very close. And, you know, often it was when we were out on the road together, I was the honorary Raybon brother. And so we joked about that. But me and Tim would talk, I don't know, man, every couple of weeks. And wound up doing a little show together in the summer of 18. Just had a random promoter call and need an act to open for a country artist. And I thought, well, now, yeah, that would be fun, but who could I get to play it to where we would enjoy it? It's not stressful. We can actually put on an entertaining show. And, you know, it come back to I knew how Tim sang, and I said, you know, Tim, you want to come up and do this show? And sure, who else can we get? And we just started, you know, calling on a few guys and put that together. And it really went well. But we always had a good chemistry on stage, far as things settling and the songs we gravitate towards and things like that. So after that, he said, you know, I've got a few songs I've wrote. I'd like to go in and cut them. And then it turned into us doing this full album, and we partnered on it and wound up on Pinecastle. And we sent them, you know, they heard about the songs we were cutting from a guy engineering it and wanted to hear them. And then they call, and we wound up doing this album. So that's how that happened. It morphed into it. You know, we originally released a Christmas song early November of last year on a compilation album they did. That was our kind of a little soft entry into the market.
That's right. I remember that.
Yeah, and that was when they did the announcement of we're going to have an album spring of 19.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, when that came out in November, we had half the album done. And, you know, Tim, we've already got a song completed for the next record, to be honest with you, because Tim was writing, you know, and he had wrote Beautiful Kentucky that's on the album and sent it to me after this album was done. And we pulled a song on this album and put Beautiful Kentucky on it.
Oh, okay.
And some of that we just, you know, bluegrass day. We love, absolutely love the Osborne Brothers. And of course, you know, Monroe's from there. And I said, man, he said, do we need to go back in the studio? And I said, yep, we do. We need to cut that. And we went in and cut Beautiful Kentucky. And the song we pulled off the record, it wasn't because it was a lesser song, but we just really wanted that song on there.
Well, you know, it's funny that tune, Beautiful Kentucky, it sounds like it should have been already written and recorded. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It has, and Tim Raybon, who I only know through this project, and you knew him, and I knew of Marty and the band, and I knew of you, but phenomenal range, great singer, and he's written so many great songs. But Beautiful Kentucky, it's like, yeah, that's not a standard at all. It's a brand new song.
It's brand new. And it was, the funny thing is, you know, I think he wrote six or seven of the tracks on the album.
Yeah.
He wrote over half the record.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them he would write while mowing his yard or while just doing obscure things, you know. I have trouble chewing gum and walking, much less mowing a yard and writing a song like that. You know, so he would just call me up, and we were very methodical about putting the album together. We was not on a huge time crunch. You know, it was a very, very enjoyable process to get to record that album, especially with him. And he would send me vocal parts, too. I sing the part under his high lead on the album and on Beautiful Kentucky. And Tim can sing absolutely any part.
Mm-hmm.
He can sing any part. And some of that stuff, you know, I sing parts, but Tim is an actual just a state-of-the-art part singer. Anything from tenor to a bass line,
he
knows the parts. And he, in the studio, it was just so fun to do that with him. Because on a few of the tunes, I would hear a harmony line, and he would hear a little something different, and we would figure out now which one, what do we need to do here, which one's going to be the best blend. And on Beautiful Kentucky, my part, and I would describe it kind of like a pedal steel thing, my harmony part on one of that is moving up to a like a seventh note, and the lower part is moving down while mine is moving up, and it just makes for a good blend there.
It's a great blend. It was a great blend. And then if you drop down in the sequence on the album, Blessed City, man, those vocals on that are really, really stunning.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Tim, I'm telling you, man, he's such a perfectionist, too. He just does not like to... you know, for things to be worked out in the mix. He wants it right on the front end. And, boy, he can do it. And just such a pleasure to work with him.
Daniel, I don't want listeners to not know who I'm talking to and who are listening. I know a lot about your past for a lot of reasons, but let's just take a little bit of a journey. I know you play with Jim and Jesse and the Osborne Brothers and lots of other, and Marty Raybon when I saw you, but take just a second, and because we get to a point where you're out of the music picture, then you're back in again strong with Merle Monroe. But maybe the people listening don't know who Daniel Grindstaff is. If you just do that for a few minutes.
Well, I would assume most of them don't.
Well, they're gonna.
I don't know why they would.
They're gonna. Go ahead. Let's talk
they're
about.
Gonna.
Yeah, let's talk about Daniel Grindstaff.
Man, I tell you, it's the music stuff I've been blessed to do. You know, is not anything I could have worked out. I did work very, very hard to do as good of a job as I could do. But when I was 18, I just got out of high school, and I'd met some guys that had worked with Jim and Jesse McReynolds, you know, at the Opry. And I'd got to know Sonny pretty well, Osborne, and some of the guys that worked with them. And that's all I wanted to do from the time I was 12. The first bluegrass I heard was the Osborne Brothers. They did a cut of Midnight Flyer. It's on the Mac Wiseman album that they did on CMH. Now, they did two albums with Mac. This was on the latter one with CMH.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, man, I thought, that's what I need to do. I need to figure out how to do that. And I was just obsessed with the Osborne Brothers, you know. Now, granted, I never learned necessarily to replicate everything Sonny did note for note, but I listened to their music enough to where that made the impression. And the reason I got into Flat and Scruggs is because of reading articles on Sonny, he just kept saying that man was the best. And I thought, well, if Sonny says it, well, I guess he's got to be the best. And then I got into Flat and Scruggs and Jim and Jesse and, you know, some Monroe music and just different things there.
Well, you just absorbed it, that's all.
Oh, that's all I did. That was my thing. That was after school, before school. That's what I thought about during grade school, you know, high school. And, you know, I got to around the house. So we had a lot of people that would get together and play, and I got to doing that. So by the time I got into high school, you know, I got to know some of those guys just from any time they were within a couple hours. I would talk whoever I could and take me to see either Jim and Jesse or the Osborne Brothers or J.D. Crowe. That was my three big ones, you know. That's who I wanted to see. And so, you know, it's a repetitive phase. They kind of got to figuring out that, hey, you know, I was trying to learn to play banjo because it was, if it was a Lifetime movie, I would have been the stalker out just watching these guys, you know, every move they were making. So,
not if they caught you, you wouldn't.
No, not if they caught me. But, you know, they were so kind. Oh, my goodness. Like, Sonny would, he kind of took to me. He knew I was trying to learn to play banjo. Man, he'd let me carry his banjo to the bus and just things like that. It was just such a huge deal when you're that young. Well, it'd be a big deal now. Luckily, I didn't know how much that banjo was worth then. I probably would have been too scared to carry it. But anyway, so Jim and Jesse had a guy that had put in his notice and was leaving the band. And another guy in the band said, called me up and said, look, I really think you can do this. They don't know. They haven't heard you play. I have. So I want you to go on a trip with us to Mississippi, and we'll use that trip. You know, you can kind of get to know them a little bit and pretty well just kind of play some, and we'll try to see if you're going to work. Well, I went to Mississippi and, went pretty well, and I wound up playing bass with them the 3 months while that guy was leaving. So my first instrument with Jim and Jesse, I was playing bass with them. And I had to go buy one to do it. That was the funny thing. You know, I had to go buy one to be able to do that. But so I went on a trip to Mississippi. It was the last half of my senior year. I just March of that year. And then the next 2 weeks later, I went to Virginia, and then I went to, you know, on. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm moving over to banjo, and we always had the dressing room with Sonny and Bobby. You know, and that was the last year Jim was living. So Jim had gotten sick in that time, and, you know, he kind of went downhill pretty quick. So he passed the next January after I had come out on the road with him. And we had another guy singing with us. You know, so we always had the dressing room with Sonny and Bobby, so I got to be around them even, you know, more so. We was down there, man, if we wasn't on the road, we were at the Opry. And a lot of the road shows we did were with Sonny and Bobby as well. So fast forward, you know, a few years, and Sonny has his rotator cuff surgery, and I wound up, you know, they had moved Dana Cup over to banjo, and for the shows that Dana couldn't make, I wound up playing banjo with them as well.
Okay, now I understand that. I remember when he had the surgery. Okay, I get it now. I get it.
Sure, yeah. So he wound up calling me, and I was still working with Jesse at the time. But I guess Sonny had to know that as much as I'd been around them and paid attention, I probably, at least if I didn't know their material, I had a good idea, which I probably knew it better than any other material at the, you know, that I would have known from my years of learning to play banjo. And I just got back in on a trip with Jesse, and Sonny had called on a Sunday and wanted me to play the Opry on a Tuesday. They had started doing special shows on Tuesday at that time. And that was my first show with them. Was August of 2004. It was my first show with Sonny and Bobby. Funny thing is, it was their 40th Opry anniversary too. So
no
they
pressure.
Opry,
no pressure.
Yeah, we didn't run over anything at all, and I was too afraid to ask him if we needed to.
Well, you tell the story. Get to where you're going on stage. Oh, that just blows my mind still to this day.
Oh, it's crazy, man. I was at the time. I tell all this stuff, and I was telling Tim, I said, I believe people think I'm like 50 or 60 years old, and I'm not, you know. I was, at the time, I was 20. You know, I was 20 years old. Nervous wreck. Luckily, I had played, honest to goodness, luckily I had played the Opry before, or I would have passed out. You know, I thought, this is so weird. Like, this is the reason that I wanted to play banjo. And I, honest, people would make fun of me, because they would say, when is the Osborne Brothers ever going to need a banjo player? Why are you wasting your time learning that stuff? Honest, this
really?
Is... Really? Yeah. They say, why? Why are you doing that? It's futile. They're never, you know, they're never going to need a banjo player. Well, come to find out, yeah, they did. And so anyway, we're standing in the dressing room, and me and Sonny were close at that time, you know, and still are. But I felt like we got to know each other. But I knew better than to ask him. And I look over to Bobby, and I said, well, do you want to run over anything? And he says, no, I've got my part. to this day, I wouldn't even lock eyes with Sonny, because I don't know if he heard it or not. So I wouldn't even look at him. Well, we walk out on stage, and I knew that August was their anniversary month for being Opry members, but I didn't know, you know, when they were going to celebrate it. And still, like, it's go time. And they're doing a longer set. Usually you do one or two songs, but they're doing a longer set on the Tuesday night. Well, Eddie Stubbs starts introducing them. And, man, he's running down the accolades, you know, the CMA vocal group and the Hall of Fame, this and that, yeah, and the state songs. And I've got it here at the house. I've got a board tape up.
Huh.
And I'm thinking, oh, geez. And Sonny, during this introduction, Sonny looks over and says, do you know the Count on Midnight Flyer? I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding. I said, yeah. He's like, are you sure? Yeah. I went, okay, well, look, yeah, if you tell me you know it, I'm going to depend on that. Don't mess it up. And he says, Midnight Flyer, Sunny Side of the Mountain, Kentucky, and Rocky Top, and we don't talk much, so make sure you're ready. And right then, about the time he says that, Eddie Stubbs says, and celebrating their 40th anniversary here with us tonight at the Grand Ole Opry, make welcome the fabulous Osborne Brothers.
So you're in it. You're in it, man. You're in it with that much notice. You're in it.
That much notice. And I thought, I can't believe I'm doing this, you know. And, man, Sonny was pouring it on me. He was right over my shoulder for most of that show. But I loved it. Oh, it's gosh, that's such a good memory. I can close my eyes and still.
I guess so.
That's been a lot of years ago.
You got pictures. I know you. We've talked about this. You got pictures from that on stage somewhere.
Oh, right? Yeah. I still don't know who took them, but I've got them. I've got them. And, you know, Sonny introduced me that night, too. So I've got the board tape of it in photos, and you know, and I've been so blessed to do stuff, but that's so special, because that's one of the first songs I ever heard that made me want to think, man, this has it, this music right here has it, and it's just something different, And I was about 11 or 12 years old at the time.
When you heard it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there I was. I was 20, and I thought, man, this can't be real, you know. It can't be real. That one did it. Now, I met later on, you know, Sonny had quit doing the road dates, and I was out in Missouri with Bobby, and that's where I met Marty Rapin at.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, so I wound up, you know, they were slowing down, and at that time, Jesse had slowed down quite a bit. You know, Bobby was still working a lot, and I was working quite a bit, but I wound up meeting Marty, and because he loves the Osborne brothers, him and his brothers, he and Tim and his other brother in Florida, Rick, loved them and still do. So Marty had come around the wings to listen to Bobby. He hadn't seen him in a few years. Wound up getting to know Marty and going to work with him. The last 6 years I played, I was out with Marty. Still fill in with Bobby, you know. I'm fortunate to do so. I played a couple of shows with him at the Opry last year, matter of fact. I just love those guys. So, you know, that's kind of the timeline there.
Yeah, that's the shortened version. And I saw you then for the first time I met you. I knew of you. And the first time I met you with Marty. So then with Marty, that's where you connect initially with Tim, his brother, and then these years later you're back, and for the reasons you've alluded to, now you're back and have formed Merle Monroe, which started out kind of last year, and then you did the Christmas single, and now you have this Back to the Country album that was just released on Pinecastle.
I'm telling you, you
and I have talked about this before. This is a band sound. There's so many great players, and I don't want to leave anybody out. And we'll talk about them as we can. And your banjo playing, which is second to none. You are a very, very fierce backup player, and you give. In other words, people aren't going to. What was the other album that I have of yours that has April Fool? The song that Sonny, the tune that. What's the
yeah,
name?
Yeah, my banjo album.
Yeah. That you, there aren't going to be any instrumentals. There are no flashy instrumental things. But banjo players, Daniel, banjo players will listen to what you're doing and recognize that you learned your lessons well. That the important part is the backup and the support and the notes that you play behind someone and the choices that you make. And it fits so well into this whole band sound that I listen to it and I think there doesn't have to be a flashy or instrumental, or I don't have to hear a banjo instrumental or solo, because I get what you're doing, because I think that's the hardest part of. I play at banjo, all right, and I'm better at sometimes than I have other times, but that was always the hardest part to me, was that filling in and not stepping on the song and supporting the singer.
Sure.
And man, you've learned that. You've learned that like you were born to do it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, I'm not doing anything, in my opinion, I'm not doing anything that hasn't already been done. JD was great at it. Sonny was a genius at it. Earl was so good at it. There's other players that's good at it.
But you have to do it.
You have to do it. And you have to think at the end of the day, what is this song about? The average person... that's going to listen to this and enjoy it. What is the song about? Well, it's about the message, it's about the lyrics, and it's about the vocals. Okay, well, if that's the case, how do I make that better?
Right. That's
now,
right.
Sometimes that's not playing at all. You know, we cut a song on there, and you may end up playing it, but we did the Merle Haggard song, Mama's Hungry Eyes.
Right.
The banjo is just very sparse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the feel of the song. I could have easily overplayed that one, and maybe I underplayed it. But for me,
no.
I wanted it to breathe. And I told Tim that. I said, I want banjo on every song on this record, but on this one, I just really want that to breathe. Vocals, guitar, let's have the fiddle pad on it. I'm going to do something here, but it's going to have intent behind it. I'm not just going to play to be playing.
And Daniel, all the things that you're expressing now is what I'm trying to help you say. You're doing it so well. You're thinking about this process, the process of playing the banjo, and whether it's the Hungry Eyes or whatever. You do two Merle Haggard tunes on this but you're thinking about how can I make this better and how can, what can I do with my banjo? And yeah, okay, Sonny was the best ever, Earl, JD, backup and everything, but you've thought it through and you recognize where the tune has to breathe and where there has to be spaces. It's not always what you play, it's sometimes what you don't play and when. But you, this is the perfect example of what a banjo player needs to do to support the sound of the band sound. And okay, yeah, people have done it before, but you're doing it now, and you're doing it at a really well thought out. You have a lot of knowledge which you put toward. Maybe you didn't have it when you were 18 or 20. I don't know, but right now you do, and it's in good supply on this album. What you do with the banjo players are going to know right away, and everybody's going to love the album. But banjo players are going to know that Daniel is doing the exact right stuff.
And
you know, I'm just telling you, that's what I hear on it. That's what I listen for.
Thank you. Well, you know, there's one thing about that album is I got to really relax and take my time on cutting the banjo. Now, it didn't take necessarily a lot of time to cut it, but I really got to think about, okay, let's listen to this song. Okay, let me hear it again. You know, and I listened to it, and I was thinking, Tim is a very emotional singer. So is Marty. Now, they don't sing alike by no means, but they fray. Mm-hmm. They're brothers. They phrase alike a lot of times. Two total different voices. If you didn't know they were kin,
you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't even know.
If they changed, one of them changed their last name. We've talked about this before.
You wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know, but they both have so much range and passion.
Oh, man. Yeah. But they both know how to deliver the lyric of a song. They do have that in common. As good as anybody I've ever seen do it. And so, man, it just really makes that easy on a banjo player because that's how I play. And in a way, that could be a flaw in my playing because, you know, I'm just I don't ever really play something that the exact same way. There's always just something different, an inflection or just, you know, I'll play off that singer. And Tim sings. You know, he'll sing something a little different. So therefore, I could play something. I'm playing off of his vocal, and I got to do that with this album. And I got to really, really listen to the songs, and we got to really choose the songs. And the songs, the new songs, we built those in the studio. You know, even the Roger Miller thing we did. If you go back and listen to that song that Roger Miller wrote,
right, the last song on the album.
You know, we arranged that the whole thing in the studio, and that was just such a joy to do that, rather than, you know, you walk in and play for another artist and they're pretty well telling you, well, this is what we want, this, you know, they've already done it. Well, we got to do that.
Yeah,
you know, we got to say, okay, well, this is how we hear this song coming out, and you know, this is let's work on this. And of course the other guys had input. If they had an idea, man, we just kind of harnessed all that and surrounded ourselves with some good players to do it.
It's the 12th song, the final song on the album, and it is, I think, the most up-tempo of everything on there.
Oh, it's the fastest.
It's
the fastest song I've ever recorded.
It just burns. It just burns, and it's a joy. It's neat to leave the album with that type of energy, and I know we could discuss for a whole nother session about the placement of the songs and how they're laid out, but I love the fact that here comes This Town, and, man, it's just burning. It's just burning. You're still playing within the song. And everybody's still playing within the song, but it's up-tempo like nothing else on the whole set.
Yeah. Banjo on that one's, you know, it's heavier. But on if you contrast that to, say, Mama's Hungry Eyes or Dad, the banjo, the dynamic is just totally, totally different. And, you know, that's what I was trying to do because they're different songs, and we wanted the album to be a variety, and you know that's how the title come about while working on the album. You know, the Back to the Country title come out of the song we had cut back, a song called Back Where It's At, and it's a mid tempo song, just a real fun tune. And you know, when we were talking with the guy that handles Pine Castle, you know, I mentioned that to him. I said, man, it's we've really got a good variety on this record. I'm really happy with the variety. We got some gospel songs.
Yep.
We got some straight ahead bluegrass. We got a couple of things that's a little more contemporary. But it's just, I'm really happy with this variety. And it's almost like the whole album is kind of, and I was talking with Tim about it. It's more tied in with the, you know, the people that make America click, kind of the heartland.
Right.
So the back to the country thing not necessarily means country music. It's just country in general. You know, it's just an overall theme of when, you know, it's our best attempt at, you know, our heroes who made us want to play.
Right.
And we're not necessarily trying to copy them as much as we are saying, well, this is our influences and this is new music because of those influences.
Well, and you mentioned earlier, Tim probably has a half a dozen original tunes, but you also cover, you do cover two Merle Haggard tunes and then the Roger Miller tune. The second cut on the album is, I don't know, Bobby Bond. I don't know who he is, but back
yeah.
where it's at, that's a song that describes exactly what you're trying to say.
Sure.
You're on a road, when each side is a field on the road, and that's that, you know, you find a grass road and either there's a field on either side of it. That's the
sure.
country part that you're talking about, that part.
Right.
Of, you know, that part
back
of the field.
To the, you know, back to the country. I've always said that, you know, music speaks to people. It's a universal language. Music is a universal language. And, you know, there's a group of people out there who have gravitated towards authentic country and bluegrass and Americana and that music because it's desirable to them, but it's not accessible on mainstream radio.
Well, you got that right.
You know, it's just not accessible on there. They don't want to hear, and you just run into them more and more and more, and you know, music, and they enjoy old music, and you know, so that had dwelled in my mind for a lot of years. I mean, for a lot of years, just how, you know, those people are there in their 40 and 50 and 30s, and some of them's in their 20s, and you know, but it applies to all age groups, but it's not as accessible. So the back to the country theme was, you know, back to a you know, simple. A lot of those arrangements are simple. The songs are simple, but it's just, you know, two kinds of music, good and bad.
Yeah.
We just want to cut a very, very good
album.
It's
good. It's very pleasing. All of it's pleasing. Yeah. You have. You mentioned a little bit the two gospel tunes, which I would count as Blessed City and He Will Roll You Over the Tide.
Sure.
Those are great. The vocals are powerful. Those are good gospel numbers that you've chosen to do. Those are the kind of things that people want to hear, and maybe that's what I'm picking up on, what the message you're trying to make. The Kindest Man. I mean,
Jim wrote that one.
It's about a grandpa, and my great grandfather, I could maybe put in that position, but everybody has, and it's going to relate to everybody differently.
Sure.
My great grandfather would probably be that man that Tim is describing, and that you guys write me. But somebody's going to find a way to connect that with either a father or a brother or an uncle or whatever in their family. And that's just a great song about that guy that's there and does things for everybody and just always, you can always count on him.
Right. And one thing about that, like, you know, The Kindest Man, Tim wrote that. And he had, you know, it's just one of those things. He'd call me and said, well, I want you to hear this song. If you think it's going to be a good dynamic for this record, great. If not, we'll hold it. But, you know, it's just there's emotional ties to that stuff. And that's something not necessarily lost in bluegrass, but lost in music in general.
Absolutely.
You know, my grandpa, who died in, he died before I ever got out of high school, but he's who taught me to drive when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we cut the song Dad, and, man, I just had my second child. He's 4 weeks old right now. And I've got a six-year-old, and I sat there, me and Tim both. You can hear it, and I would not let him change it. But the very last of his vocal, he was tearing up. You know, his dad was a fiddle player. And, you know, it's just an emotional tie to the songs. And that's what music is supposed to do. I cried I told him when I had to go in and cut my vocal on it and the banjo, I had to get immune to the song because it meant that much to me. And I thought about, you know, my dad's a banjo player. And I never really took lessons from him, but he's the one that had all the Osborne Brothers records. And
there
he's the one that helped me get to playing. And then, you know, I think about just the people in music that were just kind to me when I was this kid who just showed up and was blessed to work with bluegrass royalty, you know. And so all those, it's just that emotional time. And that was what I love. That's what I love about music anyway.
It is.
That's what I hope that, you know, that's what I hope people can enjoy about that album.
Well, and Daniel, and if you're just tuned in, I'm talking to Daniel Grindstaff about Merle Monroe, Back to the Country. And we have, you and I have talked about that, not on the show, but we've had many conversations, which people will find out about soon enough. But I think that's exactly your purpose, the connect. And I think that all these songs, for different reasons, you've made good choices. And they're not all from, you know, you choose other authors, other songwriters, and when you make those things connect with people, that's the way, I guess if I had to describe the feel of the album, it connects. It connects with everyone's going to listen to it. Every song on here, like we can extrapolate forever, Dad, who Dad is, or who the kindest man is, or who, you know, the I'll follow you. That's, you know, that's more of a there's your stalker song right there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, there you go, Sonny. You're listening.
That's a kinder stalker song. But I mean,
yeah.
So that's a love song and all these, and Whippoorwill,
sure.
Beautiful book. But all these tunes connect. And I really think it wasn't an accident. I think that's, I know how your mind works. I know you're a bright guy and you looked at this as something to, as something that you wanted to make right. I don't know Tim except through you, which I trust your judgments about him. Clearly his singing is phenomenal and the touch that he has. So I think this album does all those things that you were trying to do, and I think you're going to be happy with the traction that it gets in all different sorts of, we'll say, genres or musical.
Sure.
You know, it's going to be everywhere. It's got something that, and I don't think you're trying to make something that, let's make an album that appeals to everyone, to every different, but I think you're trying to make something that connects, and it does for a lot of different reasons. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, and that's the goal, is we wanted something real. You know, look, not everyone's going to like everything you do, and I'm fine with that. You know, there's people that like different banjo styles or different music styles, and that's what makes the world wonderful in a lot of ways. But we wanted something real, and we wanted songs that told just a message, some type of story that either would lift somebody up or make them think about someone that's important to them, or just a way of life that's important that may not be here anymore. You know, and, you know, we didn't even have a band name. And Tim, we were just tossing around, and, you know, my last name's not really conducive to one.
No.
You know, there was a country act back in the 90s, I think, that was Grandstaff, which is pretty doggone close
to
mine.
That's close.
And I don't think they had a lot of songs out, so that might not have been a good choice. You know?
I would have said no had you asked me. I'd have said no, skip on down the list.
Yeah, skip on down the list. So we got to thinking, as this album evolved and our business plan evolved, but all that was thought out. You know, we had meetings about it and just talked about what is our objective, how are we going to do it, how are we going to get from point A to point B with this. It just was not, once the ball got into motion, the happenstance was over. You know, we sat down and said, okay, well, let's get a plan together. And we kept going back to how, at one point in music, it was just good music. It was, you know, bluegrass was not all that segregated. You had country, and you had bluegrass, and you had Sonny and Bobby touring with Merle Haggard. You had, you know, all Jim and Jesse out with mainstream country acts, because at that time they were a mainstream country
act. Yes, they were.
If people go back and review this stuff, you know, Sonny and Bobby were CMA Vocal Group of the Year, you know, and had worked the White House and had these state songs. And, you know, Jim and Jesse had a lot of success. And, of course, Monroe was on all, you know, primetime country. The Opry was televised. Just all these shows, they were included on. I know I'm leaving people out, but you get the moral of the story is, you know, it's the Merle Monroe thing Tim come up with that, and he said, you know, it's just different, and it ties in with us saying that era of music is why we do what we do. You know, look, we're not saying we're as good as those guys, but we're saying that those guys were so good, that's why we want to play music. That's why we want to create new music, is our love for it as kids. And that's what it was. And, you know, Tim can sing a country ballad with him and a guitar just as good as he can sing, you know, Whippoorwill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about as straight up kind of lonesome bluegrass, mm-hmm. I guess, as we can do, or that we did on the album. And they're just saying, hey, you know, we got 12 tracks here. Some of them a little country flavored, authentic country, I guess. Some of them's gospel, and some of them's bluegrass, and some of them's got a little Americana feel to them. But it's, you know, hey, it's Merle Monroe. It's just good music, we hope. And, you know, there's two kinds of music, good and bad. And you know, that's the way I've always looked at it. So that's how the band name come about.
I think the album, the band name, I think everything that you and Tim have thought, and it wasn't an accident. You got together with a plan, like you said, and I think you made great choices. I know you might have. I would guess that, is there a website people can find Merle Monroe?
Sure, okay. MerleMonroeBand.com.
Easy enough.
The album's out now. You can it's on iTunes, all the digital outlets to download. If folks still prefer a hard copy of the album, we have them in stock. They're on the website. Pretty easy little form there to go check out. And price includes shipping on them. You can go hear samples of it. We got some YouTubes out on Dad in this town. Got some more special things coming down the pike as well, as far as just promoting some of the songs. And we've got a few shows and concerts and this year, and we've got a few good things lined up for 2020 as well. So.
Well, I think people should look for you out there. And I will say this, Daniel, between you and I and anyone else listening, I've really enjoyed the last, people will find out what we're talking about, but the last several months of having more contact with you directly rather than obliquely through Sonny and back and forth, I've really enjoyed getting to know you better. I knew of your music, and this has given me a great opportunity to get to know Daniel Grindstaff much better.
Well, I appreciate that.
It's been a blast, brother.
Well, thank you, sir. Oh, yeah, same here. And, you know, I can't remember where it was we met at, but I remember meeting you. I know it was in Kentucky.
It was a church festival in Campbell County.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to get to talk with you, and especially about music. And, you know, I appreciate what you're doing to promote. We need more people like you.
Appreciate it.
You know, your radio show and your time at IBMA, the whole nine yards, man. Just know that there's plenty of folks out there who appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that knowledge. Daniel Grindstaff, I'll find you somewhere down the road, buddy, I promise.
Sounds great.
We'll continue these conversations, whether people know about it or not. We'll continue knowing each other. I appreciate it. And I will call you this. Daniel, thanks a lot. You know I had to do that.
Oh, yeah. I love it, man.
I know.
Ain't but a certain few uses that one.
I know.
It's special to me.
I know. So, all right, brother. Listen.
You're welcome to use it.
Thank you so much, man. I'll talk to you. I'll catch you down the road, I promise.
Sound good, Steve. Thank you, sir.
All right, see you. Bye.